Chapter 6, Part 2. The priests, finding the resolution of the Duke, did all they could to prejudice his mind against the Waldenses, but the Duke told them that though he was unacquainted with the religious tenets of these people, yet he had always found them quiet, faithful, and obedient, and therefore he determined they should no longer be persecuted. The priests now had recourse to the most palpable and absurd falsehoods. They assured the Duke that he was mistaken in the Waldenses, for they were a wicked set of people, and highly addicted to intemperance, uncleanness, blasphemy, adultery, incest, and many other abominable crimes, and that they were even monsters in nature, for their children were born with black throats, with four rows of teeth, and bodies all over hairy. The Duke was not so devoid of common sense as to give credit to what the priests said, though they affirmed in the most solemn manner the truth of their assertions. He, however, sent 12 very learned and sensible gentlemen into the Piedmontese valleys to examine into the real character of the inhabitants. These gentlemen, after travelling through all their towns and villages, and conversing with people of every rank among the Waldenses, returned to the Duke, and gave him the most favourable account of these people, affirming, before the faces of the priests who vilified them, that they were harmless, inoffensive, loyal, friendly, industrious, and pious, that they abhorred the crimes of which they were accused, and that, should any individual, through his depravity, fall into any of these crimes, he would, by their laws, be punished in the most exemplary manner. With respect to the children, the gentleman said, the priests had told the most gross and ridiculous falsities, for they were neither born with black throats, teeth in their mouths, nor hair on their bodies, but were as fine children as could be seen. And to convince your highness of what we have said, continued one of the gentlemen, we have brought 12 of the principal male inhabitants, who are come to ask pardon in the name of the rest, for having taken up arms without your leave, though even in their own defence, and to preserve their lives from their merciless enemies. And we have likewise brought several women, with children of various ages, that your highness may have an opportunity of personally examining them as much as you please. The Duke, after accepting the apology of the 12 delegates, conversing with the women, and examining the children, graciously dismissed them. He then commanded the priests who had attempted to mislead him immediately to leave the court, and gave strict orders that the persecution should cease throughout his dominions. The Waldenses had enjoyed peace many years, when Philip the 7th Duke of Savoy died, and his successor happened to be a very bigoted papist. About the same time, some of the principal Waldenses proposed that their clergy should preach in public, that every one might know the purity of their doctrines, for hitherto they had preached only in private, and to such congregations as they well knew to consist of none but persons of the reformed religion. On hearing these proceedings, the new Duke was greatly exasperated, and sent a considerable body of troops into the valleys, swearing that if the people would not change their religion, he would have them flayed alive. The commander of the troops soon found the impracticability of conquering them with the number of men he had with him. He therefore sent word to the Duke that the idea of subjugating the Waldenses with so small a force was ridiculous, that those people were better acquainted with the country than any that were with him, that they had secured all the passes, were well armed, and resolutely determined to defend themselves, and with respect to flaying them alive, he said, that every skin belonging to those people would cost him the lives of a dozen of his subjects. Terrified at this information, the Duke withdrew the troops, determining to act not by force, but by stratagem. He therefore ordered rewards for the taking of any of the Waldenses, who might be found straying from their places of security, and these, when taken, were either flayed alive or burnt. The Waldenses had hitherto only had the New Testament and a few books of the Old, in the Waldensian tongue, but they determined now to have the sacred writings complete in their own language. They therefore employed a Swiss printer to furnish them with a complete edition of the Old and New Testaments in the Waldensian tongue, which he did for the consideration of 1,500 crowns of gold, paid him by those pious people. Pope Paul III, a bigoted papist, ascending the pontifical chair, immediately solicited the Parliament of Turin to persecute the Waldenses, as the most pernicious of all heretics. The Parliament readily agreed, when several were suddenly apprehended and burnt by their order. Among these was Bartholomew Hector, a bookseller and stationer of Turin, who was brought up a Roman Catholic, but having read some treatises written by the reformed clergy, was fully convinced of the errors of the Church of Rome. Yet his mind was for some time wavering, and he hardly knew what persuasion to embrace. At length, however, he fully embraced the reformed religion, and was apprehended, as we have already mentioned, and burnt by order of the Parliament of Turin. A consultation was now held by the Parliament of Turin, in which it was agreed to send deputies to the valleys of Piedmont with the following propositions. Number 1. That if the Waldenses would come to the bosom of the Church of Rome and embrace the Roman Catholic religion, they should enjoy their houses, properties, and lands, and live with their families without the least molestation. Number 2. That to prove their obedience, they should send 12 of their principal persons, with all their ministers and schoolmasters, to Turin, to be dealt with at discretion. Number 3. That the Pope, the King of France, and the Duke of Savoy approved of and authorized the proceedings of the Parliament of Turin upon this occasion. Number 4. That if the Waldenses of the valleys of Piedmont refused to comply with these propositions, persecution should ensue, and certain death be their portion. To each of these propositions the Waldenses nobly replied in the following manner, answering them respectively. Number 1. That no considerations whatever should make them renounce their religion. Number 2. That they would never consent to commit their best and most respectable friends to the custody and discretion of their worst and most inveterate enemies. Number 3. That they valued the approbation of the King of Kings who reigns in heaven more than any temporal authority. Number 4. That their souls were more precious than their bodies. These pointed and spirited replies greatly exasperated the Parliament of Turin. They continued, with more avidity than ever, to kidnap such Waldenses as did not act with proper precaution, who were sure to suffer the most cruel deaths. Among these, it unfortunately happened that they got hold of Geoffrey Barnagle, minister of Angoulême, whom they committed to the flames as a heretic. They then solicited a considerable body of troops of the King of France, in order to exterminate the reformed entirely from the valleys of Piedmont. But just as the troops were going to march, the Protestant princes of Germany interposed, and threatened to send troops to assist the Waldenses if they should be attacked. The King of France, not caring to enter into a war, remanded the troops, and sent word to the Parliament of Turin that he could not spare any troops at present to act in Piedmont. The members of the Parliament were greatly vexed at this disappointment, and the persecution gradually ceased, for as they could only put to death such of the reformed as they caught by chance, and as the Waldenses daily grew more cautious, their cruelty was obliged to subside, for want of objects on whom to exercise it. After the Waldenses had enjoyed a few years' tranquillity, they were again disturbed by the following means. The Pope's nuncio, coming to Turin to the Duke of Savoy upon business, told that prince he was astonished he had not yet either rooted out the Waldenses from the valleys of Piedmont entirely, or compelled them to enter into the bosom of the Church, that he could not help looking upon such conduct with a suspicious eye, and that he really thought him a favourer of those heretics, and should report the affair accordingly to His Holiness the Pope. Stung by this reflection, and unwilling to be misrepresented to the Pope, the Duke determined to act with the greatest severity, in order to show his zeal, and to make amends for former neglect by future cruelty. He accordingly issued express orders for all of the Waldenses to attend Mass regularly on pain of death. This they absolutely refused to do, on which he entered the Piedmontese valleys with a formidable body of troops, and began a most furious persecution, in which great numbers were hanged, drowned, ripped open, tied to trees, and pierced with prongs, thrown from precipices, burnt, stabbed, racked to death, crucified with their heads downwards, worried by dogs, etc. Those who fled had their goods plundered, and their houses burnt to the ground. They were particularly cruel when they caught a minister or a schoolmaster, whom they put to such exquisite tortures as are almost incredible to conceive. If any whom they took seemed wavering in their faith, they did not put them to death, but sent them to the galleys, to be made converts by dint of hardships. The most cruel persecutors, upon this occasion, that attended the Duke, were three in number, viz. 1. Thomas Inchemell, an apostate, for he was brought up in the reformed religion, but renounced his faith, embraced the errors of popery, and turned monk. He was a great libertine, given to unnatural crimes, and sordidly solicitous for plunder of the Waldenses. 2. Corbis, a man of a very ferocious and cruel nature, whose business was to examine the prisoners. 3. The Provost of Justice, who was very anxious for the execution of the Waldenses, as every execution put money in his pocket. These three persons were unmerciful to the last degree, and wherever they came the blood of the innocent was sure to flow. Exclusive of these cruelties exercised by the Duke, by these three persons and the army, in their different marches, many local barbarities were committed. At Pinerol, a town in the valleys, was a monastery, the monks of which, finding they might injure the reformed with impunity, began to plunder the houses and pull down the churches of the Waldenses. Not meeting with any opposition, they seized upon the persons of those unhappy people, murdering the men, confining the women, and putting the children to Roman Catholic nurses. The Roman Catholic inhabitants of the Valley of St. Martin, likewise, did all they could to torment the labouring Waldenses. They destroyed their churches, burnt their houses, seized their properties, stole their cattle, converted their lands to their own use, committed their ministers to the flames, and drove the Waldenses to the woods, where they had nothing to subsist on but wild roots, the bark of trees, etc. Some Roman Catholic ruffians, having seized a minister as he was going to preach, determined to take him to a convenient place and burn him. His parishioners, having intelligence of this affair, the men armed themselves, pursued the ruffians, and seemed determined to rescue their minister, which the ruffians no sooner perceived than they stabbed the poor gentleman, and leaving him weltering in his blood, made a precipitate retreat. The astonished parishioners did all they could to recover him, but in vain, for the weapon had touched the vital parts, and he expired as they were carrying him home. The monks of Pinerol, having a great inclination to get the minister of a town in the valleys, called Saint-Germain, into their power, hired a band of ruffians for the purpose of apprehending him. These fellows were conducted by a treacherous person, who had formerly been a servant to the clergyman, and who perfectly well knew a secret way to the house, by which he could lead them without alarming the neighbourhood. The guide knocked at the door, and being asked who was there, answered in his own name. The clergyman, not expecting any injury from a person on whom he had heaped favours, immediately opened the door, but perceiving the ruffians, he started back and fled to a back door. But they rushed in, followed and seized him. Having murdered all his family, they made him proceed towards Pinerol, goading him all the way with pikes, lances, swords, etc. He was kept a considerable time in prison, and then fastened to the stake to be burnt. When two women of the Waldenses, who had renounced their religion to save their lives, were ordered to carry faggots to the stake to burn him, and as they laid them down to say, "Take these, thou wicked heretic, in recompense for the pernicious doctrines thou hast taught us." These words they both repeated to him, to which he calmly replied, "I formerly taught you well, but you have since learned ill." The fire was then put to the faggots, and he was speedily consumed, calling upon the name of the Lord as long as his voice permitted. As the troops of ruffians belonging to the monks did great mischief about the town of Saint-Germain, murdering and plundering many of the inhabitants, the reformed of Lucerne and Angoulême sent some bands of armed men to the assistance of their brethren of Saint-Germain. These bodies of armed men frequently attacked the ruffians and often put them to rout, which so terrified the monks that they left the monastery of Pinerol for some time, until they could procure a body of regular troops to guard them. The Duke, not thinking himself so successful as he at first imagined he should be, greatly augmented his forces. He ordered the bands of ruffians belonging to the monks to join him, and commanded that a general jail delivery should take place, providing the persons released would bear arms and form themselves into light companies, to assist in the extermination of the Waldenses. The Waldenses, being informed of the proceedings, secured as much of their properties as they could, and quitted the valleys, retired to the rocks and caves among the Alps, for it is to be understood that the valleys of Piedmont are situated at the foot of those prodigious mountains called the Alps, or the Alpine Hills. The army now began to plunder and burn the towns and villages wherever they came, but the troops could not force the passes to the Alps, which were gallantly defended by the Waldenses, who always repulsed their enemies. But if any fell into the hands of the troops, they were sure to be treated with the most barbarous severity. A soldier, having caught one of the Waldenses, bit his right ear off, saying, "I will carry this member of that wicked heretic with me into my own country, and preserve it as a rarity. He then stabbed the man and threw him into a ditch. A party of the troops found a venerable man, upwards of 100 years of age, together with his granddaughter, a maiden of about 18, in a cave. They butchered the poor old man in the most inhuman manner, and then attempted to ravish the girl, when she started away and fled from them, but they pursuing her, she threw herself from a precipice and perished. In order the more effectually to be able to repel force by force, entered into a league with the Protestant powers of Germany, and with the Reformed of Dauphiny and Pagela. These were respectively to furnish bodies of troops, and the Waldenses determined, when thus reinforced, to quit the mountains of the Alps, where they must soon have perished as the winter was coming on, and to force the Duke's army to evacuate their native valleys. The Duke of Savoy was now tired of the war. It had cost him great fatigue and anxiety of mind, a vast number of men, and very considerable sums of money. It had been much more tedious and bloody than he expected, as well as more expensive than he could at first have imagined, for he thought the plunder would have discharged the expenses of the expedition. But in this he was mistaken, for the Pope's nuncio, the bishops, monks, and other ecclesiastics who attended the army and encouraged the war, sunk the greatest part of the wealth that was taken under various pretences. For these reasons, and the death of his duchess, of which he had just received intelligence, and fearing that the Waldenses, by the treaties they had entered into, would become more powerful than ever, he determined to return to Turin with his army, and to make peace with the Waldenses. This resolution he executed, though greatly against the will of the ecclesiastics, who were the chief gainers, and the best pleased with revenge. Before the articles of peace could be ratified, the Duke himself died, soon after his return to Turin, but on his deathbed he strictly enjoined his son to perform what he intended, and to be as favourable as possible to the Waldenses. The Duke's son, Charles Emmanuel, succeeded to the dominions of Savoy, and gave a full ratification of peace to the Waldenses, according to the last injunctions of his father, though the ecclesiastics did all they could to persuade him to the contrary.
An account of the persecutions in Venice. While the state of Venice was free from inquisitors, a great number of Protestants fixed their residence there, and many converts were made by the purity of the doctrines they professed, and the inoffensiveness of the conversations they used. The Pope, being informed of the great increase of Protestantism, in the year 1542, sent inquisitors to Venice to make an inquiry into the matter, and apprehend such as they might deem obnoxious persons. Hence a severe persecution began, and many worthy persons were martyred for serving God with purity, and scorning the trappings of idolatry. Various were the modes by which the Protestants were deprived of life, but one particular method, which was first invented upon this occasion, we shall describe. As soon as the sentence was passed, the prisoner had an iron chain which ran through a great stone fastened to his body. He was then laid flat upon a plank, with his face upwards, and rowed between two boats to a certain distance at sea, when the two boats separated, and he was sunk to the bottom by the weight of the stone. If any denied the jurisdiction of the inquisitors of Venice, they were sent to Rome, where, being committed purposely to damp prisons, and never called to a hearing, their flesh mortified, and they died miserably in jail. A citizen of Venice, Antonio Ricchetti, being apprehended as a Protestant, was sentenced to be drowned in the manner we've already described. A few days previous to the time appointed for his execution, his son went to see him, and begged him to recant that his life might be saved, and himself not left fatherless, to which the father replied, "A good Christian is bound to relinquish not only goods and children, but life itself, for the glory of his Redeemer. Therefore I am resolved to sacrifice everything in this transitory world for the sake of salvation in a world that will last to eternity." The lords of Venice likewise sent him word that if he would embrace the Roman Catholic religion, they would not only give him his life, but redeem a considerable estate which he had mortgaged, and freely present him with it. This, however, he absolutely refused to comply with, sending word to the nobles that he valued his soul beyond all other considerations, and being told that a fellow prisoner, named Francis Sega, had recanted, he answered, "If he has forsaken God, I pity him, but I shall continue steadfast in my duty." Finding all endeavors to persuade him to renounce his faith ineffectual, he was executed according to his sentence, dying cheerfully, and recommending his soul fervently to the Almighty. What Ricchetti had been told concerning the apostasy of Francis Sega was absolutely false, for he had never offered to recant, but steadfastly persisted in his faith, and was executed a few days after Ricchetti in the very same manner. Francis Spinola, a Protestant gentleman of very great learning, being apprehended by order of the inquisitors, was carried before their tribunal. A treatise on the Lord's Supper was then put into his hands, and he was asked if he knew the author of it. To which he replied, "I confess myself to be the author of it, and at the same time solemnly affirm there is not a line in it, but what is authorized by and consonant to the Holy Scriptures." On this confession he was committed close prisoner to a dungeon for several days. Being brought to a second examination, he charged the Pope's legate and the inquisitors with being merciless barbarians, and then represented the superstitions and idolatry practiced by the Church of Rome in so glaring a light that, not being able to refute his arguments, they sent him back to his dungeon to make him repent of what he had said. On his third examination, they asked him if he would recant his error, to which he answered that the doctrines he maintained were not erroneous, being purely the same as those which Christ and his apostles had taught, and which were handed down to us in the sacred writings. The inquisitors then sentenced him to be drowned, which was executed in the manner already described. He went to meet death with the utmost serenity, seemed to wish for the dissolution, and declaring that the prolongation of his life did but tend to retard that real happiness which could only be expected in the world to come. An account of several different remarkable individuals were martyred in different parts of Italy on account of their religion. John Mollius was born at Rome, of reputable parents. At 12 years of age, they placed him in the monastery of Grey Friars, where he made such a rapid progress in arts, sciences, and languages, that at 18 years of age he was permitted to take priest's orders. He was then sent to Ferrara, where, after pursuing his studies 6 years longer, he was made theological reader in the university of that city. He now unhappily exerted his great talents to disguise the gospel truths, and to varnish over the error of the Church of Rome. After some years' residence in Ferrara, he moved to the University of Bohemia, where he became a professor. Having read some treatises written by ministers of the Reformed religion, he grew fully sensible of the errors of popery, and soon became a zealous Protestant in his heart. He now determined to expound, accordingly to the purity of the gospel, St. Paul's epistle to the Romans, in a regular course of sermons. The concourse of people that continually attended his preaching was surprising, but when the priests found the tenor of his doctrines, they dispatched an account of the affair to Rome. When the Pope sent a monk named Cornelius to Bohemia to expound the same epistle according to the tenets of the Church of Rome, the people, however, found such a disparity between the two preachers that the audience of Mollius increased, and Cornelius was forced to preach to empty benches. Cornelius wrote an account of his bad success to the Pope, who immediately sent an order to apprehend Mollius, who was seized upon accordingly and kept in close confinement. The bishop of Bohemia sent him word that he must recant or be burnt, but he appealed to Rome and was removed hither. At Rome he begged to have a public trial, but that the Pope absolutely denied him, and commanded him to give an account of his opinions in writing, which he did under the following heads: original sin, free will, the infallibility of the Church of Rome, the infallibility of the Pope, justification by faith, purgatory, transubstantiation, mass, auricular confession, prayers for the dead, the host, prayers for saints, going on pilgrimages, extreme unction, performing services in an unknown tongue, etc., etc. All these he confirmed from scripture authority. The Pope, upon this occasion, for political reasons, spared him for the present, but soon after had him apprehended and put to death, he being first hanged and his body burnt to ashes, A.D. 1553. The year after, Francis Gamba, a Lombard of the Protestant persuasion, was apprehended and condemned to death by the Senate of Milan. At the place of execution, a monk presented a cross to him, to whom he said, "My mind is so full of the real merits and goodness of Christ, that I want not a piece of senseless stick to put me in mind of him." For this expression his tongue was bored through, and he was afterward burnt. A.D. 5055. Algirius, a student in the University of Padua, and a man of great learning, having embraced the Reformed religion, did all he could to convert others. For these proceedings he was accused of heresy to the Pope, and, being apprehended, was commended to the prison at Venice. The Pope, being informed of Algirius's great learning and surprising natural abilities, thought it would be of infinite service to the Church of Rome if he could induce him to forsake the Protestant cause. He, therefore, sent for him to Rome, and tried, by the most profane promises, to win him to his purpose. But finding his endeavors ineffectual, he ordered him to be burnt, which sentence was executed accordingly. A.D. 1559. John Aloysius, being sent from Geneva to preach in Calabria, was there apprehended as a Protestant, carried to Rome and burnt by order of the Pope, and James Bobelius, for the same reason, was burnt at Messina. A.D. 1560, Pope Pius IV ordered all the Protestants to be severely persecuted throughout the Italian states, when great numbers of every age, sex, and condition suffered martyrdom. Concerning the cruelties practiced upon this occasion, a learned and humane Roman Catholic thus spoke of them in a letter to a noble lord.